the week of September 8th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 204, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, out here in Los Angeles, the temperatures and the weather is as hot as it could possibly be.
Here, it's beautiful and perfect. A crisp fall day as the U.S. Open ends at Flushing in Queens at the Arthur Ashe Tennis Center. I'm saying the Billie Jean Tennis Center at the Arthur Ashe Stadium. I'll be watching it on TV. Nobody wants to give me free tickets for the finals. I don't know why, but I went to a lot of tennis this year and I'm looking forward to the men's finals. I guess I'm rooting for, I don't know what. I don't like Djokovic, but I don't want Nadal to get too close to Federer. So I'm rooting for them both to lose, I guess.
Wow. Well, I don't exactly know how that could happen.
I'm not sure it can happen, but people will win if they listen to our podcast, won't they? What will they hear about?
Well, actually, they're going to hear about two losers, I think.
Okay.
Time Warner Cable and CBS, because on today's show, we're actually going to focus on two things, television and books. More specifically, as I just mentioned, we're going to find out how the dispute between Time Warner Cable and CBS was ultimately resolved. And of course, it was resolved by, you know, making consumers the real big losers. We'll also have a rundown from you, Michael, of some of the season's new television series, which ones are worth watching, which ones, you know, we'll probably never take a look at. On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss Amazon's attempt to launch bundling and why the publishing world isn't really all that interested. As well, we have another company hoping you'll stop buying books altogether and just rent them. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to you, Michael, entertainment and journalist extraordinaire. You're going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're talking about the worldwide box office, not just North America. The number one movie around the world is Vin Diesel's Riddick, which opened to $26 million worldwide. It was the number one movie around the world. It was also the number one movie in North America, where it made $18 million. And number two around the world is Matt Damon's Elysium. That grossed another $24 million. It's at $212 million and counting. At number three around the world is We're the Millers, the comedy with Jennifer Aniston. That grossed another $17 million. That's at $178 million worldwide. That's really turning into a substantial hit.
At number four, that is unbelievable. $178 million for what is essentially a comedy.
Not a very good comedy. I had a friend who saw it and said, that's dumb. That movie was dumb.
And that's not the good kind of dumb. It's the bad kind of dumb?
Apparently.
Okay.
At number four around the world is White House Down, the Channing Tatum action. That's Channing Tatum, right?
I believe so. It's one of those guys.
Another $12 million. That's at $150 million and counting. At number five, One Direction, the concert film about the boy band One Direction. This is us. It grossed $11 million worldwide. It's at $50 million and counting. But here's what people said. They said, oh, it collapsed 74% in its second week, and it's a disaster. Oh, people ran away from it screaming. It's like, it's made $50 million. That's a massive amount of money for a concert film. It only cost $10 million to make. This is a big, big success story, no matter how you slice it. People say, oh, it looks like their 10 minutes, 15 minutes of fame are gone. It's like, no, they have a new album coming out in a few weeks. The film was a big hit. They're doing great. They'll be fine. At number six around the world is Planes, the Disney animated spinoff from Cars. They made another $11 million. It's at $121 million and counting. At number seven, The Conjuring, the low-budget but very successful horror flick. Another $9 million. That's at $260 million.
Yeah, I would say that's, when you say very successful, I mean, that's just off the charts success.
That's the kind of hit they just love. The only thing better than a big blockbuster budgeted movie that you know, makes $1 billion like Iron Man 3 is something like The Conjuring, where they make it for pennies and it still makes a ton of money. They love that sort of film. At number eight is Lee Daniels' The Butler, a film on a modest budget that has made a lot of money. It's at $8.9 million it made this weekend, all in North America. It's at $92 million and counting, all in the U.S. It's clearly going to get to $100 million. They probably won't even release it overseas.
I bet you they release it in a few countries, but not, you're right. I think the number of markets for this film are limited.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I agree that they're not going to release them, but I think that's stupid. I don't think that the market is limited. I think they're just dumb. You look at 42, best movie about baseball and about a black man. That movie wasn't even released anywhere in the rest of the world. Didn't make a single penny overseas. The Tyler Perry films, they haven't released any of them overseas. I think they're losing out. I think there's money to be made. I think it's stupid. Lee Daniels, The Butler, is going to be an Oscar nominee. It is a prestige project. It has a lot of big name people. Oprah's one of the most famous people in the world. Don't tell me that this movie couldn't make money overseas. It could.
No, I'm agreeing with you. I think what I'm saying is I don't think they're going to open it in many territories overseas.
But you said it had a limit. Its marketability overseas was limited. I thought you just said that.
Well, that may have come out that way. What I mean is they're going to hold this movie back and not market it throughout the world the way they should. And by the way, The Help had the same issue initially. Eventually, it went on to actually make quite a bit of money internationally.
Well, that, of course, was about white people talking about black people. So that's why that happened. That was not a film, you know, that film featured black actors in supporting roles, but the leads were white people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm shocked that 42 didn't play in, like, the UK.
The Help made $38 million overseas. So it made $170 million in the U.S. and another $38 million overseas. $38 million is $38 million for a movie that didn't cost a lot to make. It cost $25 million to make. So that's, you know, that's a good chunk of change.
Yeah, you know, I know one of the executives that was on the committee that greenlit that movie. And when it was time for him to vote to whether to make The Help or not, he said no, because there's no overseas market for it. And he is the first person to admit he was wrong about that.
Well, it wasn't a big overseas success. That wasn't, I mean, he just made so much money in the U.S., it didn't matter.
Well,
everything
but
overseas
he thought
was gravy.
Instead of $38 million, he thought they would be taking in zero. So
right.
That's $40 million of found money.
All right, well, we've talked about this before. We'll probably talk about it again. At number nine around the world is Percy Jackson, Sea of Monsters, another $8 million. That's $150 million. At number 10 is Smurfs 2, another $8 million. That's at $267 million. And number 11, still quite a strong success story. Instructions not included. This is the...
It's an indie film.
It's an indie film in Spanish. It grossed $8 million. It's at $20 million and counting. It held very well. You know, this is at number... Where is it in the U.S.? Number 3. So it increased its take by 3%. It almost doubled the number of screens it's on. It made 11,000 per screen. This is getting good word of mouth. It's the number 3 film in the country. I forget what the schedule is coming out in the next week or two. If it got really lucky, it might have even hit number 1 at some point. But this is going to be one of the big success stories of the year, I think. Another $20 million. It's $20 million total. It will play overseas. It's a strong success story and a smart sign that you should be reaching out to as many different audiences as possible. At number 12 is Mortal Instruments, City of Bones. That's at $58 million worldwide. The Adam Sandler film, that's at $213 million. Here's another film that's brand new. It's called The Spy, Undercover Operation. It grossed $6.4 million in South Korea. It's another action comedy in that country, which just seems to be churning out hit after hit, at least in their home territory. They are really on fire there. I mean, their movies, and just from South Korea, are breaking into the top 15 worldwide because they're making a lot of movies and their audiences are flocking to see them.
Well, you know, this is not a new story. South Korea has always had a very big film market and one in which they churned out hit movies. The Ring, for instance, is a remake of a South Korean film.
That's true. And at number 15, just out on DVD and Blu-ray in the U.S. is Now You See Me, another $5 million. It's not done. It's made $317 million worldwide. Then Despicable Me 2, Monsters University, they're still adding to their big coffers. And at the bottom is Two Guns. That grossed $3.8 million worldwide. It's at $75 million and counting. I think it has to be counted as somewhat of a disappointment. It was a Mark Wahlberg, Denzel Washington film. It's made $72 million in the U.S. alone. It cost $60 million to make. It's sort of like Now You See Me. It's in that mid-range, but it's an action film, and they were probably hoping to at least double or triple their budget, and they're not coming close to that yet.
Now, have you seen the movie Now You See Me?
I haven't, but I have it right here on DVD.
Yeah, it was actually pretty good. I mean, you know, it's not an epic.
Not going to change the world.
Yeah, it's not a classic epic, but it was an enjoyable viewing. Let's put it that way.
Sure, and it's got a cast that appeals to everybody. Jesse Eisenberg and Mark Ruffalo for young people. Woody Harrelson for the middle-aged people. Michael Caine and Morgan Freeman for the adults. The whole family can sit down and watch it. Except, wait, it's PG-13. Maybe it's not appropriate.
Well, I will say, Jesse Eisenberg, I swear he plays the same character every single time.
I think he's a terrific actor. He's done comedies. He's done drama. I don't think he plays the same character. He has a certain personality, I understand. It's sort of an intellectual, nervous,
right,
sarcastic, Woody Allen-ish sort of guy. Yeah, but I think he's a very good actor.
It was like the character from The Social Network learned how to do magic and starred in this film.
Well, Vin Diesel, it had the number one film in the world.
That's true.
That's Riddick.
That's probably the second time this year that's happened.
Well, yeah, he was in Fast and Furious 6, right? Are we up to 6 now, was it?
Yes, I believe so.
And he talked on Craig Ferguson about how his dream project is to make a movie about Hannibal. Not Hannibal Lecter, but Hannibal the Carthaginian general with all those elephants. He's got a great script, but the budget worked out to $250 million, to which I would say, I don't think so. But he's been trying to get the movie made for years, presumably trying to figure out ways to keep the budget lower. But every time he makes a new Fast and Furious film, he says, he gets closer and closer to being able to make his dream project because he becomes a more bankable star.
You know, he got his start as a filmmaker.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I guess there was, many years ago in the mid-90s, there was a documentary on Sundance, and he was featured in it for his directorial debut, which screened at Sundance. And I'm trying to look it up now as I speak. And I guess it was called Multifacial was his short, but it was Strays, I believe, that went to Sundance. And it was very interesting looking at that movie, even before Boiler Room is when I saw that film. Because he was very egotistical, talking about how I'm gonna go to Sundance, I'm gonna win Sundance, I'm gonna, you know, be a big time director. But in the end, what really made him, besides Fast and Furious, was of course Saving Private Ryan.
That made him a star?
Well, that brought him to a level of recognition where he was landing movies like Boiler Room and Pitch Black. And XXX and so on. So what made him a star, of course, were movies like Fast and Furious and XXX. Those were huge movies. However, what brought him to the attention of the industry were movies like Saving Private Ryan.
You get cast in a Spielberg film, of course, that can only help. I don't get your point. He shouldn't have been cocky. He said he's going to be a big guy, and now he's a big guy.
No, I mean, I thought it was just very, it was like he was playing a persona in this documentary. I've met him several times. He's incredibly nice.
Uh-huh. And he's a former bouncer, just like Craig Ferguson.
Oh, really? I did not know that. Wow, you really have been watching Craig Ferguson a lot.
Well, I love Craig Ferguson. He's my favorite talk show host right now.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah, he's the best. And of course, can you get in trouble for lying to investors?
I think you probably can.
Because when you have those conference calls and you talk about your company and how your movies are doing, I'm just wondering, because Jeffrey Katzenberg blithely said that the animated film Turbo, oh, that's going to make money. Ah, we'll make money on that. Don't you worry about that movie. Well, Turbo has dropped off the charts already, even while Despicable Me 2 and Monsters University continue to pile in some dough. It grossed $155 million worldwide, which is just over the $135 million it cost to make the film. Now, maybe it hasn't opened in China. I don't know. Maybe it's got some big markets left. We'll have to wait and see. But even if it opened in China and grossed $100 million, which isn't going to happen, it'd still only take $25 million out of the country. So that means at best, you're looking at $180 million for this movie, and it costs $135 million to make. They may not lose their shirt, but that's certainly not a profitable film.
No, not at all.
No. All right, just wondering.
I think everybody would agree that Turbo did not make money. In fact, when I saw it was about a racing snail, I thought this is either going to be a huge hit and it's going to have a great story to it, or nobody will go see this movie. And it was the latter. And this was like 3 years ago when it was announced at some convention and some trade show.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. So that's the box office. We should move on to television.
Ugh, television.
Because I'm going to be watching the tennis in a few minutes. It's going to be on CBS, and I'll be watching Rafael Nadal and Djokovic compete in the men's U.S. Open final. Thank goodness CBS and Time Warner Cable came to an agreement. So here in New York, I can watch the finals and I don't have to sit on my laptop and watch it online.
You know, to be honest with you, I almost want to boycott CBS.
CBS?
CBS, yes.
They just want more money for their product. They got a great channel. They want to make money. They look at all these cable channels and say, how come they get advertising plus they get to get paid to have their channel? Why don't we get the same thing?
Well, I can tell you why they don't get the same thing.
But they do get the same thing.
Well, they do now, yes, thanks to the 1992 Cable Act. Here's the thing. I mean, retransmission and we...
Wait, stop. First of all, let's tell us what happened. Time Warner Cable and CBS came to a deal. What happened?
So what happened was CBS was asking $2 per subscriber per month over the next 5 years.
And what did they get?
And they got $2 per month per subscriber over the next 5 years. And Time Warner Cable said, well, look, you know, we'll pay you more for your content there, CBS, but you can't then go sell that same content two-hour competitors, Hulu and Netflix. And CBS said, yeah, we can, as a matter of fact. And we will. So Time Warner Cable
wanted it to be exclusive content. They wanted to establish a standard, which nobody else has, of saying, well, if you're going to be on our cable service, you can't be on an online provider as well.
Right. And or they wanted to, like, you know, have that be part of what they were purchasing. And CBS said, well, no, now you're preventing us from selling it in another form. And this whole thing, this dispute...
Did Time Warner Cable get there? They also wanted to be able to include CBS on their Time Warner Cable to go, if I can describe that properly that way. Did they get that ability?
I think they may have.
Okay,
so
that means that, you know, you can stream it onto your tablet or whatever if you're in your home, stuff like that.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
So Time Warner Cable got basically nothing it wanted. CBS got basically everything it wanted.
Right. And in doing so, they actually have set such a huge precedent that now every other broadcast network...
All three of them.
Well, no, there's five.
No, there's three. Three others. CBS, ABC, NBC, and Fox. CW is not a broadcast network. I'm sorry.
Well...
They're not. They're not going to get anything like the others. They're not even... No. They don't even show up 7 days a week.
No. Now, no. The whole thing with retransmission and the reason it was allowed was...
What do you mean allowed? What's retransmission?
Retransmission is taking a local
over
feed...
Over the air.
So basically, one of the broadcast networks that the FCC here in the United States gives spectrum to so that they can broadcast and you can pick it up with an antenna. Part of the problem in the early 90s was you had all these regional, localized monopolies for cable. And they were kind of rolling over the broadcast networks. And so Congress said, well...
But they wanted to show broadcast networks on their cable channel.
That's right. And broadcast networks said, well, why would we do that? They're going to be charging money for something that we're giving away for free, which is paid for by these advertisements. And so Congress said, okay, well, we'll let you charge a retransmission fee. In 2005, CBS was charging a 15-cent per month per subscriber transmission fee. They're basically going to take the broadcast networks alone, retransmission fees from $3 billion this year to $12 billion in 2020.
That's the estimate if the other channels get similar deals to what CBS got.
Right, and which everybody's
expecting.
And
who will pay for that extra $9 billion?
The customers. The customer, right. Any cable customer and any satellite customer will be paying these retransmission fees.
Or they could put an antenna out their window and get it for free.
Right. Now, part of the reason, again, that Congress created this whole retransmission consent thing in the 1992 Cable Act was to kind of level the playing field so that broadcast networks had the same power and the same strength as these cable providers, not cable networks, but cable providers. However, now everything is going in reverse. They did this to help local broadcasters. So there's two types of network broadcast network affiliates. There's CBS in Los Angeles and New York and Dallas, owned by CBS outright. They're owned and operated, O&Os, as they call them in the industry.
Uh-huh.
And then there's affiliates who pay and actually receive retransmission, their own, you know, retransmission rights from local cable providers. So Charter, in some instances, if you're in Arizona or wherever Charter is from, or Cox in Atlanta, they will pay the local CBS affiliate a retransmission fee. CBS, the parent company, will then take a part of that fee.
So what's your problem?
My problem with this is that there effectively was no way for Time Warner Cable to fight back here. They couldn't
negotiate because they needed to have a network channel on their cable system.
Well, I wrote to them saying, feel free to just do away with CBS.
Well, you're the only person who did, because I pay $160 a month and I say, why the heck am I not getting one of the major networks? I don't care what you did or do. I'm paying $160. I want my major network. I want ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. Maybe I don't want the House and Garden channel, but I sure as heck expect the major network.
Well, and that's the network's point of view. They're saying, hey, you know what? That's very true. You know, most of what people watch is on these broadcast networks, is on CBS or ABC.
They say,
or
we want $50 a month.
Right. And so what the multi-video providers, the cable networks, are saying is, hey, you know, when ABC comes to us and they want extra money, they bundle in ESPN. and they say, we're coming to negotiate retransmission fees for ABC, ESPN, the Disney Channel, and all of these networks all at once. So it's kind of like collusion. And that is allowed. It is allowed. Congress, in the 1992 Cable Act, you can, there are these local clearances where you can actually, you know, collude with other networks, even ones you don't own. Multi-video providers, cable providers, and satellite providers cannot do that. They cannot basically all get together in a room and say, what are we as an industry going to pay for CBS?
All right. So what's the problem and what do you need to fix? You're saying the cable providers have to provide the channels, so the networks have them over a barrel. So what do you want to change?
Here's what I would like to see change, because you're right, I'm pointing out a huge problem. But before I tell you what I'd like to see change, can I just point something out? Because I never agree with this particular person.
All right.
Newt Gingrich, okay, former congressman from Georgia.
You don't agree with him? You don't love America?
Well, you know.
All right, keep going.
October 5th, 1992, Republican congressman from Georgia, as I mentioned. The only bill to be where the veto for President George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, was overturned was the Cable Act. He said, retransmission means the cable companies will now pay the broadcasters to broadcast on cable, something which broadcasters have already sold advertising to pay for. And if you are a cable viewer, you will both get to watch the advertising and pay a higher fee. Now,
which is what happens on most cable channels.
Right. However,
right. It's like FX. It's like MTV. It's like ESPN.
Yeah, how much
it's like every other cable
channel.
How much do you
pay per month for FX?
I pay too much.
Right.
I pay
you probably
too
don't
much.
Pay not $2 a month.
It doesn't matter what my cable provider, my bill is a lot, but there are plenty of cable channels that have advertising that are also I have to pay for on my bill. So that doesn't make CBS any different from ESPN or MTV or FX or CNN or any of these other channels. They're all the same. I know they have this government thing. Nobody cares anymore.
Well, first of all, one of the biggest problems, and by the way,
the idea that it's a Shonda that you would pay to watch a channel that you already have to watch advertising on is outdated.
Yeah, so I don't care about that. I mean,
all right.
I don't care about that.
Well, you quoted it. It's 20 years ago, and it's silly at this point.
Right. So you've got 20-year-old legislation regulating an industry that has advanced significantly.
Changes. So what happens? What do you want to change?
I think the FCC needs to step in. They have been mandated to help protect the consumer in this instance. They did nothing. Instead, what they did was they said, sure, Comcast, you can be both a multi-video, multi-network.
Comcast.
Yes, Comcast now owns NBC.
Well, why are we talking about NBC now suddenly?
Well, because Comcast was dead set against retransmission fees. They hated it. They you know, spoke
all right,
out.
We were talking about CBS and Time Warner Cable. What should the FCC
the
have done?
Issue.
Or what do you want them to do now?
They need to do a couple things. If they want to keep the retransmission fees there, that's fine. They have to take back the spectrum. They need to basically go to CBS and say, you're no longer a broadcast network. You no longer have the ability.
Make them a cable channel.
Make them a cable channel. You know, because part of being a broadcast network is you have a responsibility to do certain public service things, such as the evening news, the local news. You know what? You wouldn't have to do the local news. All of those local networks would begin to dry up. Because, you know, why give that time over to the local networks? You know what they would also have to do? CBS, ABC, and NBC, all of these broadcast networks.
Well, because they would give it up because they own the stations, a lot of them. And they're very profitable.
That's right.
Well, CBS is not going to give up local news if they're making money on it.
That is correct. Yes.
Right. All right.
So
about that. What do you want them to do?
I would like them to step in and basically
take back the airwaves and then sell it or lease it for other needs, other uses. And so then CBS will be a cable channel and will still be in the same situation that they're incredibly profitable, incredibly powerful. Everybody wants CBS. Everybody wants ESPN. And when they negotiate, they've got them over a barrel.
Right. I would also like them to do away with shared service agreements and local marketing agreements. And I'm not quite sure on that. I'd have to look into more of that. Actually, I take that back. Local marketing agreements.
Whatever. It's 5 years from now when Time Warner Cable is renegotiating with CBS. Even if they're a cable channel, they're really going to want CBS. How are they going to not have CBS on their cable channel? They won't be successful if they don't have the major networks. They don't have the biggest cable channels available, whether it's CBS or ESPN or CNN. They're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Right, but imagine if somebody was coming to you and saying, hey, I'd like to sell you this product, okay? And I'd like to raise the price on it. Now, the other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go right down the street and I'm going to start selling that product to your competitor. And you can't do anything about it. So now you're paying.
That's what happens right now. This
precisely
CBS is available
because
on
of the way
TV.
Because of the way the laws.
We want it to be available on multiple channels. That's a good thing. We want CBS to be available on satellite and cable and over the phone and other ways, because that creates competition. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Well, yes, but the competition is kind of hamstrung by the fact that the Cable Act allows for bundling and does not allow for a la carte and does not allow a cable provider or a satellite provider to sell.
But a la carte would not lower prices.
Well, who knows?
What do you think?
I don't think it would raise prices on ESPN to $30. I think that what would wind up happening is, yes, it would devastate the sports industry, because there are people like me that would not choose to get the Lakers channel or the Dodgers. Okay, technically I would, but I there are people who I wouldn't get the tennis channel, I wouldn't get the wrestling channel, I wouldn't get the NFL channel.
Well, nobody gets the wrestling channel.
Apparently, I do.
Very few people get the tennis channel. It's on my basic cable tier, actually, so I get it as far as the thing. Very few people would pay for the tennis channel. I would, but very few people. All right, so you're angry, you're upset. You suggested some things. You considered cord cutting. What's the reality about cord cutting? What's the latest info on that?
Well, can I just finish one thing?
Sure. I thought you were done.
I was done a long time ago, according to you. These local marketing agreements, they allow...
I don't even know what that is.
Well, they allow a cable...
What's a local marketing agreement?
They allow a cable provider, so Time Warner in this case...
Time Warner Cable.
Yes, to sell advertising on FX or any of the networks that are cable networks.
There are some channels who trade in-kind time. They say, all right, you take our channel, you take our shows, we'll give you a minute on every hour, 2 minutes on every hour, you can sell it on your own. Just like a syndicated deal.
Right. And basically what they're saying is, okay, yes, we're charging you a dollar for our network, or, you know, we're FX.
But you also get some of the advertising.
But you also get some of the advertising. CBS, NBC, all those broadcast networks, you have to, because of retransmission, you have to broadcast the signal as is. You can't interrupt it with your own advertising. So that needs to be done away with.
Well, not that they want to.
No, they do.
Not that CBS wants to give away some of their advertising time to cable providers?
No, they don't. Of course not.
Right. So, right.
Right.
Does ESPN give away advertising time?
Yes, they do.
But they'd prefer not to?
Absolutely right. They prefer not to, but that is part of the deal. You want a $5 retransmission fee? Fine. I'll pay you $5.
You want a five-cent retransmission fee. But that just means it's a $4 fee. It doesn't change things. Whatever the value of the package is what the value of the package is. They could charge $3.50 and keep the minutes, or they could charge $5 and give you a minute and a half every hour. It's the same thing. It doesn't change the fact of what the cost is. However, whoever wants to sell the advertising, they're going to defray the cost of either making the show or paying for the show.
That's right.
Right. So that's just a different accounting thing. It doesn't change how expensive ultimately the show is to the cable provider. So who cares?
Well, what if I was a producer, okay, and I ran a production company, and I went to CBS and said, I want to sell you this show called, what's a big show on it? You know, 8.5 Men or 2.5 Men, 8.5 Men, listen to me, 2.5 Men, okay, maybe a bad example right now, or Big Bang Theory. I want
8.5 Men sounds like a show on Bravo, but anyway.
I want to sell them Big Bang Theory, and I say, CBS, I'm willing to sell it to you for, I don't know, $5 million an episode. But here's the thing. I'm going to go to NBC. I'm going to sell it to them also so that they can run it on Thursday night.
Well, that happens, except that they're not direct competitors like that. They sell it to Hulu. They sell it to Netflix. That's perfectly normal. It's a different venue. CBS and NBC are the same thing. So your thing doesn't work. It's if CBS is available over the air and on cable and on satellite, and you can get it online. And those are different ways of getting it.
But ultimately, the product is the same thing. It is content to eyeballs.
Right.
So whether you're watching it on...
Well, there are some specials that get broadcast over more than one network. You know, whatever. Who cares? What's your point? Any innovation in television, I don't care how you sell your show. If you convince CBS and NBC to carry your show on both networks, more power to you. I don't care.
My point is, the way the laws are written today, they're 20 years old. They need to change. The FCC needs to step in and start regulating, which is their whole reason for being. They need to start actually defending the consumer.
How are they going to untangle this mess and say lower cable costs?
I don't know, because
taking back the airwaves isn't going to lower cable costs. Making CBS a cable channel and saying we're taking back your spectrum because you're not an over-the-air free broadcaster anymore, which I think CBS should do anyway. I can't see any downside. But if they did that, they'd have raised money for the government, you know, spectrum, valuable spectrum, a resource that we could use for improved internet or improved emergency broadcasting or whatever it might be. But that wouldn't lower our cable bills. What do you want them to do to lower your cable bill? Well, all you can think of is to cord cut. How many people are actually cord cutting?
Well, the last quarter, 217,000 subscribers.
Which is nothing, right? It's like almost half of what happened the same quarter the year earlier, right?
I don't know. Yeah. I believe so. But basically what's happening
the
is there's a downward trend.
In 2012, they lost 400,000 subscribers. So this time they lost 200,000 subscribers. So that's a serious decline in cord cutting, according to this study by SNL Kagan, one of the industry professionals.
Right. Well, but I guess what the problem is you don't see any, you know, subscribership growing. Now, I'll agree with you. It's not deteriorating.
Well, that's because they've reached everybody.
Well,
I mean,
correct.
What the heck? You're gonna have satellite and cable in your home?
But let me ask you this: if you were to go to your investors and say quarter after quarter
it's
after
a mature
quarter,
industry. That's
hey,
fine.
Guess what? You know, we had two customers or five customers last quarter, and now we have four. And then the quarter after that, we had four customers last quarter, and now we have three. It's not a good story to tell.
You have tens of millions of customers, and we still have tens of millions of customers. If they lost 200,000 people in a quarter, that's not exactly scary, and it's slowing down.
You know, in the past,
that's 5 to 4 is a 20% cut. That's a much bigger cut than 0.1%.
Well, coincidentally, and I'm not sure why, but over the past 2 weeks, I have spoken to two people just by chance, two people who aren't in the industry, and I wouldn't expect them to, you know, really even know what Apple TV was or what Roku was or what any of these products are. They told me, hey, you know, we actually don't get TV. We don't get cable or satellite. We cut the cord. And I'm thinking, you even know the expression cord cutting?
Everybody knows the cord cutting expression.
And I said,
and that's anecdotal evidence that isn't backed up by the facts.
And I said,
you can write a story in a newspaper saying, look at all the cord cutting going on. But the fact is there's not a lot of evidence and it's slowing down. That's what the facts show. As far as we can tell, according to the LA Times.
Well, I think
it was 400,000 in 2012 in that quarter. Now it's 200,000 this quarter. They'd rather lose none, but that's 50% slower. That's a lot. It's slowing down.
Well, back in June.
Or maybe it's.
Back in June, Craig Moffett said that it would actually continue to increase.
Who?
Craig Moffett, he's a Wall Street analyst who's known for being correct about these types of things. Now, he didn't say, oh, my goodness, the sky is falling. He said by 2020, it's going to reduce. I can't even remember the percentage, but it was like, oh, instead of 95%, it'll be like 80%. Okay, well, that's still a pretty darn good business.
But that's a huge cut.
Right.
I'd like to know what he bases that on.
Oh,
it's not happening, and it's slowing down, and people talk about it, but they don't really do it. And young people in college don't have cable. But guess what? Then they get their apartment, they get their home. Most of them get cable. They need Wi-Fi, they need a phone, just get a cable bundle.
I guess what he was referencing was the first quarter of this year, the cable subscribership dropped 0.3%, its largest drop ever. And so he kind of builds it out to 2020, and he said right now it's at 87.5%, you know, pay TV penetration, and that by the end of 2020, it will be at 82%. So it will drop 5%.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised by that because there could be other alternatives for, you know, satellite might improve. Other ways of getting television will improve. You know, the need for cable, it's not including satellite in that, it's not including.
Pay TV. So yes, he is including satellite.
Oh, okay. Anyway, we've exhausted this topic.
Well, can I just say one last thing?
Please.
Richard Greenfield.
You would just say one last thing.
Well, this is the kind of thing that what I don't like is an uneven playing field. And this playing field is now incredibly uneven. And the laws need to be changed. But what I like what Richard Greenfield has to say here. He says, broadcasters never reference the billions of dollars spent by the cable industry to provide a high-quality video experience that seamlessly integrates broadcast and cable networks together without the need for an antenna. often extending a station's reach beyond and a broadcast station's reach beyond what an over-the-air antenna yields, which also enables on-demand viewing in stark contrast to the free spectrum utilized by broadcasters. Lastly, the internet as we know it today would not exist without the investment made by the cable industry over the past 20 years, which enables broadcast networks to distribute and monetize their content in all new ways.
So, which the cable companies profit from their Wi-Fi fees, et cetera. And
correct.
As a cable internet provider.
Yes.
They're not providing charitable offerings for the networks. It's a big business.
No, but we, you know, that's
fair enough. There's a lot of benefits from cable that the broadcasters appreciate.
Sure. Yes.
But you know what I say? There's a golden age for television, but no one wants to pay for it. You know, we're like, oh, my God, there's so much great TV. Why do I have to pay for TV?
You know what? I'm willing to pay for it. But when I get a letter or a notice on my TiVo saying that I have a brand new channel at channel 827. And so I go to channel 827, which is Russia Today in Spanish. OK, I don't want that channel. I don't want to have to pay for that channel.
Well, you're not. Your bill did not increase because they added Russia Today in Spanish to your offerings. Russia Today with Spanish dubbing or captioning?
No, it was, I know, because Russia Today is kind of this offbeat network. No, it was in Spanish. Like, the people were speaking en español, as they say, and it was all
probably
Spanish.
Probably using the word maricón a fair amount of time. But anyway,
my goodness.
Well, my apologies to our Latino audience, but we're not happy with Russia right now. But anyway, your bill did not increase because that channel was added. Any more than if you got Al Jazeera America, your bill went up this week. It didn't. That's what bundling some people think is good. But if you are bundling and you are getting television, you haven't cut the cord, and you do have access to major networks, we're about to hit the fall TV season, aren't we?
Yes. Well, now, let me ask you this. Since I still have TV, and I probably won't cut the cord, although, as you can probably tell, this last little Time Warner CBS thing kerfuffle has made me think about cutting the cord. Unfortunately, I can't. I work in the industry. I kind of have to have it for certain things. What should I be watching since I have to have this TV thing?
We mean of the new shows.
Of the new shows, yeah. Like, what shows should I be watching? I know that you've seen a number of them.
Well, I've seen like 20 shows, thanks to some friends of mine who've made pilots available to me. I have missed a few shows. I'm hoping to catch up this week. But I've seen like 20 of the pilots, and you won't be surprised that the best show I saw was not on the networks.
Oh, no, I would not be surprised at all.
It was, of course, on cable. It was on Showtime, which, you know, really wants to catch up with HBO. They had the best show that I've seen for the fall. It's called Masters of Sex. It's sort of like Kinsey, the TV series. It's a show about the famed researchers into human sexuality. And it's being done on Showtime, so you can ratchet up the naughtiness a little bit. I wouldn't say it's a home run, but it's by far, out of the 20 shows I saw, by far the most interesting pilot I saw. Had a very good cast, led by Michael Sheen as Masters, and Lizzie Kaplan as Virginia Johnson, who just died in real life. It was smart. It was a little restrained, which I liked. It's more like PBS than HBO. I mean, it's not button pushing.
You're just saying that because of the British accents.
Well, it's set in America. Why would there be British accents?
Just because the actors are British, so I like to throw that in.
Okay. It's you know, it's certainly, there's, you know, people having sex while people stand there and watch them, so it's certainly enticing and a little button pushing, but it's certainly not erotic. It's not a Red Diaries type show. It's an intelligent drama. They could go off the rails and go into melodrama a bit, but I found the pilot very good. Very satisfying, and it's the one show that I would say I do want to see more episodes of this show.
Well, let me ask
you
this.
Watch this.
What about this show that's getting a lot of buzz and a lot of attention, The Blacklist?
Oh, well, that's a James Spader show. That's on NBC, and God almighty, does NBC need a hit? They haven't had a hit drama in ages. Revolution was not it, as far as I'm concerned. This really could be, to me, this looks like the most commercial hit of the fall. It's the best pilot as far as commercial prospects are concerned. It's on NBC's best time slot following The Voice on Monday nights at 10. It's a tough time slot, but it looks like, to me, this could be a real serious breakout hit for them, and they really need it. It's about James Spader. He was a Navy officer and he disappears. And then he pops up at the beginning of the show. He pops up at FBI headquarters and turns himself in. He's been the most wanted man in the world. He's been a gun for hire, working with terrorists and all sorts of people. He'll just do any job for anybody. He's not political. He just wants money. And now suddenly he's turning himself in. And they don't know why. And they treat him like Hannibal Lecter. I mean, he's got this elaborate, you know, way of confining him. It's crazy and over the top. And
I thought you meant they were serving him fava beans with a glass of Chianti.
They might as well have. I mean, they really should pay royalties to Silence of the Lambs because everything they do about him is so Hannibal Lecter. He refuses to talk to anyone except a new young recruit, this new young FBI agent. He only wants to talk to her, and they don't know why, but he's got a blacklist, a list of bad guys from around the world that he wants to bring down, and the FBI wants to bring down, and he wants to work with them. So they can't trust him. They don't know what his plan is, but he's helping them in the initial episode take down a big international terrorist. So you've got the season-long arc of who is he, what happened to him, why is he doing this now, why is he obsessed with this agent, and you also have the weekly satisfaction of bringing down a bad guy. So you don't have just one long story that you deal with all season. You get that week-to-week thrill of like, yes, there's a drug lord, you find him, you track him down, you bring him in. So that's very satisfying, but it does have what every show thinks they have to have, that season-long arc where you learn about big mysteries about James Spader, about the FBI recruit, about her husband, about what happened to him. So it was just a very slick show, very fun. And unlike a lot of shows that I've seen now and like in the past few years, it's not grim. I mean, it deals with terrorism and all this stuff, but it's fun. James Spader is like acting up a storm. He's just having a lot of fun in his character. And it's just not grim. It's not dark. You don't watch it and feel dirty afterwards like you do after like, you know, some of these shows that you're watching on TV right now. So I liked the tone of it. It's certainly serious, but it's entertaining. He's really enjoyable in the role. It's the NBC's best time slot. It's by far the most commercial pilot I saw. This is the one that I think they've really got a winner on their hands.
Well, what about, okay, so that's a drama, and that's a procedural, right?
That's a drama.
Is anybody on an island on this show, by any chance?
Well, no, but it is okay. Up against two big shows that are on CBS. ABC has Castle, which is a delightful show. It's been on for a number of years, and it's sort of long in the tooth, so I don't think that will be competition. It's also up against two shows on CBS. One is called Hostages, and in mid-season, there's a show called Intelligence. Hostages is a big glossy fall drama. It has Dylan McDermott. It has Toni Collette. And it's this elaborate, ridiculous story about a family being held hostage so that the mother, who is a surgeon, will kill the president during a surgery. So it's sort of like, how is this a series? You know, whatever. And it's so tiresome.
Yeah, how many surgeries could the president possibly get if you fail the first time?
They wanted to kill her this one day on the surgery. So, you know, it's the whole arc of the 12 episodes, it's only a half a season long, will resolve this particular issue. And then obviously something else will come up or they don't have a show. But it's sort of like the show where you feel like you have to take notes. Everybody's got a secret. I mean, the wife has a secret. The husband has a secret. Dylan McDermott has a secret. The children have a secret. I think even the dog has a secret. I mean, it's just, you know, it's very silly, crazy.
It's where he buried the bone in the backyard. That's where
exactly. So that's a classic sort of current type show. They feel like they have a season long arc. They want big stars. They want it to feel like it's a mini series, but they want to stretch it out to a series length. So it just gets very tiresome. And I don't think it'll work at all. I thought it was just a bore. And then the other one is Intelligence, which stars Josh Holloway from Lost as this new super agent, this new super warrior who gets a chip implanted into his brain. And now suddenly he's super intelligent. And when he's fighting people, he can call up the schematics of the building he's in, or he can know what vulnerable thing to do to break the bone in their neck. You know, it's just he's now the smartest warrior in the world. And it's Josh Holloway, the dude from Lost. He's like,
he was never very smart on the show. He was never the smart guy.
He's the least intelligent actor, Matt. If you were going to cast anybody.
I know. I was just thinking, wow, that's not a very good, whoever cast that was not doing.
And if there was some great contrast, like the guy was surprised at how much he knew now, that might work. But it's a brain dead movie. Brain dead TV show, very dumb. So that's the competition for the Blacklist on NBC. James Spader will get an Emmy nomination, and I don't think the other shows stand a chance.
Now, what about these comedies that everybody talks about, like the Everybody Loves Raymonds of the world?
Well, there's a lot of new comedies. Some are very traditional, like Mom, which is from Chuck Lorre, the guy who did, you know.
I can't believe you didn't call me out on like mentioning a 15-year-old TV show. But okay, go ahead, Mom.
Well, that's probably Everybody Loves Raymond is probably the last, you know, great traditional comedy.
Okay.
Most of all, in the recent years, it's been the edgier ones like Modern Family, where they sort of want to push the edge or be sort of like a docu-comedy like The Office or something like that. Everybody Loves Raymond is the kind of comedy I love, you know, a classic traditional comedy. And there's also the envelope-pushing comedies. You've got a bunch of both this season, and none of them are good. None of them. There's not a single comedy that I could barely watch the pilots. They were so bad. Some of them aren't embarrassing, like the Michael J. Fox show. That's a show where he's dealing with Parkinson's and deciding to go back to work. And then there's something like the Sean Hayes show. What's it called? It's called Sean Saves the World. And it's just, he's a single gay dad with a daughter from a marriage that he had with a woman. And it's just it's just painful. Linda Lavin is his mom, who sort of comes in and makes a sassy comment and walks out again. It was just exhausting. When a sitcom is done poorly, it's just the worst thing in the world. And there's a lot of them this season. I didn't see one that I wouldn't run screaming from the room if it came on the air.
Wow. You really do take your television seriously. No wonder you don't want to cut the cord.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of bad sitcoms. There's a lot of elaborate dramas with, season-long arcs and elaborate storylines like Believe, which is about this little girl with psychic powers who can save the world, but first she has to be protected from the bad guys. So there's Kyle MacLachlan as a mysterious figure. There's Delroy Lindo as her protector. It's just whatever, you know. She just wanders around being noble and loving and has little psychic powers and reads everybody's mind, and you just could care less. So there's a lot on the different shows. And of course, I'm talking about quality, but of course, there's also how commercial are they. I think NBC is in luck with The Blacklist, and I think the CW is going to have a good season.
Wait, the network that's not a network is going to have a good season? Okay, just
checking. NBC and the CW are as low as it gets, so they have nowhere to go but up. You know, they're really in the doldrums. So the CW last year had Arrow, which was a big success for them. And this year, I think they have a couple shows that will work for their audience. They're not good shows. They're not shows I'm going to watch. But I think they could click. They have it's called The Tomorrow People, which is a remake of a British series from the 70s. And it's about dreamy teens who have superpowers. And then they also have another show about dreamy teens from outer space, which is called Starcrossed. And they have another show about dreamy teens who are stranded on Earth after a nuclear holocaust. And that's called The 100. And I think those are all sort of in the sweet spot for their audience. And I think they're all pretty competent. Which is not an insult. I don't mean that at all. It's like a lot of these other shows I watched and I just could barely watch them. These, I thought, all right, I can see these working. They work for the CW. They make sense. They walk and talk like a TV show. I can see kids tuning in every week. So I think they're going to have a pretty good fall. It's the best crop of shows they've had in a long time.
Well, over on CBS, there's a ripoff of Mad Men. Instead of Mad Men, it's We Are Men.
Let's go. It's got nothing to do with Mad Men. It's nothing like that. Oh, okay.
It's a bad joke.
Oh, my God. It's about four guys living together in a singles apartment building. Tony Shalhoub is in it, Jerry O'Connell, Cal Penn. A lot of good actors. Oy, what a bad show. I mean, it's just...
Which apparently I could write for, given my sense of humor.
Yes, you could. You're right, and you're ready for them. Yeah, I mean, and there's some shows where you almost think they work, but they don't really. Like Robin Williams has a show called, what is it? The Crazy Ones. And he is an ad exec at a big company. And,
is it set in the 60s by any chance?
No, it's not. Okay, it's not set in the 60s. But, he is an ad exec who's got sort of ADD and he's always running around and improvising and being silly and goofy. His daughter, Sarah Michelle Gellar, who I really love, terrific actress. She's on the show trying to keep her dad in check and keep the company afloat. And then there's what's his name? The guy from they didn't even list him. The guy from Mad Men who plays that new office employee, the new hungry gopher who's always trying to finagle his way into everybody's good graces. You know who I mean?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I don't know his name.
He's on the show and he has a good supporting role. It's just a blue chip cast and you keep watching it thinking maybe it'll be good. It's not good. It's not embarrassing. Maybe some people will watch it, but it's got all the elements, got all the people on it that you could ask for, and it's Robin Williams returning to TV. It's just not a good show.
So really, Masters of Sex and The Blacklist, these are going to be the big deal shows that we hear about.
Well, I think Masters of Sex will be critically acclaimed, and I think The Blacklist will be the big, as far as the shows I've seen. I haven't seen the Marvel spinoff, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. They have kept that under lock and key, even though they showed it at Comic-Con. They have not shown it to critics or released the pilot. So I haven't seen that. I haven't seen Andy Samberg's show, Brooklyn 999. I'm hoping to get those this week, at least Brooklyn 999 and the reboot of Sleepy Hollow. So I will check out a few more pilots as soon as I get them. But as far as the ones I've seen, the biggest hit to me looks like The Blacklist. And I think Masters of Sex will get the best reviews.
Okay, well, I was trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Well, it worked.
Okay, well, our first story then is about Spider-Man. In fact, someday soon, I may not have an excuse to say, Spider-Man, turn off the dark. Why, you ask? Or maybe you don't ask. I don't know. But for at least 2 weeks in a row now, the Broadway musical dipped below $1 million per week. The $1 million a week grossing Broadway show is, of course, a rarefied club. But the problem is that Spider-Man, turn off the dark, costs $1 million a week to mount. So now it's starting to lose money, of course, and tickets are available on something called TDF. So they're being discounted. King Kong the Musical, or should I say King Kong the Musical,
might just have,
might just have the perfect home available after all. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
Well, actually, the numbers are just in like seconds ago. I just checked again, and I just got the latest Broadway figures for last week. So it's 3 weeks in a row that Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark has been below a million. Forget about that. It's below $800,000. It grossed $790,000 last week. It's a down week for most of the shows because it's the end of the summer. Tourists have left. The fall season hasn't begun. So I'm looking here. Almost every single show, except two new ones that just opened up, so they had nothing to compare it to. Every show that was on Broadway dropped this week, some very modestly. You know, I mean, you look at The Lion King and The Book of Mormon, $1.6 million each. So clearly shows are making money, but a lot of shows dropped in their grosses. But Spider-Man dropped another $180,000 from last week when it was below $1 million. So now it's below $800,000. That is really scary territory for them. That's losing a couple hundred thousand dollars a week. They only grossed half their potential. One out of four seats remained unsold, so one out of every four seats was empty. This is bad, bad news for Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. We've been waiting for a while to see when this show might finally collapse, and we may be getting there.
Boy, does it matter to NBC and the athletes, this next story. But to the rest of us, the decision as to where the 2020 Summer Olympics will be played seems more really like a distant issue. I mean, it's, what, 7 years away? Tokyo beat out Madrid and Istanbul for the honor. Istanbul has been hammered by street protests and a major doping scandal among athletes, which I have to say are probably big minuses when you're picking the, you know. Madrid, though? Well, who knows why they picked radioactive Tokyo over Madrid. But is it unfair? News stories continue to bedevil the nuclear reactor leaks that are occurring there at Fukushima, which is, you know, it's far from Tokyo and yet leaking into the ocean, which, you know, I don't think they hold the swimming events in the ocean, but it still could prove problematic for other nations, not to mention the Japanese themselves. And 4 years of bad publicity could certainly dampen tourism to the Games. Olympic officials must surely be hoping the nuclear disaster in Japan will be a distant memory rather than an ongoing source of agita. I'm going to look that word up. They hope it's going to be gone by 2020. Let's put it that way. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Why are they trying to create problems for themselves? Why not pick Madrid? Do they want Geiger counter sales to go through the roof for anybody who wants to go to the Tokyo Games? I mean, I'm not trying to be flippant here. I know it's 7 years away, but good Lord. You know, they're still struggling with this issue in infrastructure. I don't know why you'd pick a country that could seem to have a lot of negatives for it coming, you know, this close to what this horrible disaster. You know, why wouldn't you pick Madrid? I don't get it. So they've got bad troubles with Sochi in Russia right now. This is looking really bad. And this just seems like another problem that they're creating for themselves by picking a site that seems problematic right now. It's not like it's some unforeseen issue.
I guess in 7 years, they're hoping, as you say, that they're...
But it's a health issue today. Why not wait till you know it's cleared up before you say, all right, 5 years from now, we'll come to your country? I don't get it.
Maybe the health issue is agita, which, by the way, before you write in, I know what it means. Okay.
I mean, again, like Russia, this is not about the internal politics of a country. This is about the safety and the pleasure of athletes and their fans from around the world. You've got Russia actively telling people from around the world, if you're not Russian, you don't look like us, you don't act like us, we don't want you here. We're going to beat you up and throw you into jail. And it's not just gay people, it's blacks, it's other people from around the world. They're proving very unwelcoming to minorities. So that's the safety of your athletes. They don't feel safe bringing their family and friends to Russia because they're worried they'll be beat up or thrown into jail. Now they don't feel safe bringing their family and friends to Tokyo because they're worried about the health issues. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, in Madrid, I mean, have you ever been to Madrid during the summer? It's hotter than it's just blistering hot. But, you know, I think part of the reason they went to Tokyo is because, you know, when you hold an event like the Olympics in a city like Tokyo, a lot of money pours in.
Well, actually, host cities often lose money. So that's a misnomer. It's, LA
city
Olympics made money, but many countries lose money. So it is not a money-making prospect. They like to think long-term, vaguely, tourism ultimately increases. Maybe introduce people to a city or a place that they weren't familiar with. Tokyo doesn't need that sort of publicity any more than New York does. It's not a money-making venture by and large.
Well,
it
adds
prestige to the country. Prestige, not money.
Well, maybe it's because the traffic is so good in Tokyo, they thought that. Broadway attendance dropped by 250,000 this summer compared to last. But
apparently all at Spider-Man, turn off the dark.
Yes. higher ticket prices, though, kept the grosses just about even, with $323 million taken in from Memorial Day to Labor Day. That's an almost 8% drop in theater goers, with total tickets sold down to 3 million from 3.2 million last year. The New York Times singled out current underperformers like Soul Doctor, the Beatles tribute show Let It Be, and the dance show Forever Tango. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
This is a big whoop, I think. It's summertime is often a very good time for Broadway. I think it's a bad long-term trend. You know, if your attendance is down, you should lower prices, not raise them. I don't know why the Times singled out these shows. They're all minor shows that were just going to be out for a few weeks in the summer to fill up a house until a new big show came along.
So wait, I mean, you're saying that somehow the market should actually work so that when you're trying to sell something that people don't want, it should go down. Much like if you're trying to sell something that is now non-exclusive, the price should drop. Interesting.
Well, I think what's happening is that the biggest shows keep raising their prices. So The Lion King and The Book of Mormon and Wicked just keep raising their prices again and again. So the overall ticket price increases, but I'm sure a lot of the other shows were discounted during the summer, were half price, were whatever, like Spider-Man. People aren't going. They're now available on TDF. So I think that's probably happening to a degree, but I think they don't recognize that when they price the top shows so expensively, they scare people off to the other shows as well. And I think that's the biggest problem. They make their product seem like opera, where nobody's ever going to want to go to a Broadway show again.
Paramount really, really, really wants Chinese citizens to go see the next Transformers movie. They've cast Chinese stars in some key supporting roles, and now they've cast four more actors from the country for tiny parts via a reality TV show.
And this I love the name of the show.
I was going to say, this is the best part of this story. The TV show is called simply Transformers 4 Chinese Actors Talent Search Reality Show. It's exactly
gotta
what it
be.
Is.
That's got to be the translation. It can't be that direct.
Yeah. It drew tens of thousands of applications and aired on TV recently as the winners were announced. Paramount is, of course, hoping to qualify as a Sino-US co-production so they can get a guaranteed release date and a bigger slice of the box office. The last Transformer movie grossed more in China than anywhere else in the world outside the US. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay.
And I think it's a very awkward, you should do it because you think it's a good idea, not because you're hoping for the long shot of them saying, okay, you're an actual Chinese co-production and we'll give you more money.
Especially when they continuously change what makes you a Chinese co-production.
Yes, but you know, we've had reality shows cast musicals in the West End and Broadway. Them seeing them doing it now for movies is kind of intriguing.
Rick Robertson, the chief operating officer of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, has stepped down after 32 years with the institution. Robertson was up for the top job, but lost out to Don Hudson. And I don't want to say he was up for it. He was, you know, probably the most likely candidate.
He was the second in command, practically, wasn't he?
Yes, for most of his tenure.
And then they named him officially the second in command. So, of course, he's up for the top job.
Right. And so when they decided, you know what?
He lost it. He didn't get it.
Right.
They said, we'll give you the consolation prize and call you COO, because that was a new title they created when Don Hudson got the top job.
Right. Now
he lost it. He lost it. Well, why are you afraid to say that?
Well, because it was never his. They assumed that they would be, you know, it would be.
If I'm a vice president and they're going to name a new head of the company and another vice and somebody else gets the job, I've lost out.
You've lost out. Yes. But that doesn't necessarily mean you were up for the job in the first place, meaning you lost it.
You must be the only person in Hollywood who doesn't think he was considered for the job.
No, I think like most people. Everybody thought he was being considered for the job, and they decided to go outside.
Okay.
Now, However, a summer-long hiatus has become permanent, with Robertson announcing he was leaving for good. He'll still do some consulting work for the Academy, which is either a fig leaf or a sign of how valuable he is as a resource for institutional memory at the Academy, which a lot of people do believe. Some wonder if this is another sign the Academy might leave behind its hidebound ways. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, I'm too stupid. I've never heard of him. It's a sign of me not being in L.A., not knowing the work of the Academy. He's obviously a well-known figure to everyone in Hollywood. At the luncheon, he announces the names of everybody there because he's the one who knows everybody and can get all the details right. Everybody knows him who matters. I've never heard of him. So let me ask you, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Time will tell whether it's a big deal or not. Either, you know, people, you know, look, they wanted to move on from tradition and they hired Dawn Hudson. So I think
his days were numbered at that point.
Yes. So it'll be, and they're not even replacing him. So I think that it'll be interesting. Look, he was there for 30 years during a 30-year time span when people said the Academy became slowly started to matter less and less. Although I would argue that they do a lot of scientific work and they do a lot of preservation work. And so their libraries, which he was in charge of, are really great resources.
Yeah, the Margaret Herrick Library, which takes telephone research questions from people all over the world, I think is great. It's always been terrific for me.
Yes. And going there, let me tell you something. You think that you get scanned and prodded at the airport. Let me tell you, go to the Margaret Herrick Library. They'll search you six ways to Sunday.
Yeah, they're not nicer on the phone than they are in person, from what I understand, as far as the attendance. But
no, they're nice about it. I'm making fun of it, but they do.
No, I heard a friend who was very, they were very persnickety and, you know, cranky, weird people, you know, eccentrically difficult people. Like, you want to look at my stuff? Whereas on the phone, they're very friendly. But anyway, that's not important. He was in charge of helping them launch electronic voting, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. That did not go so well.
Right. That didn't help a lot. But that was already happening
with or
after
him.
They chose Dawn Steele, right? Yeah. And that was, yeah. So whether he would have been a wave of the future and could adapt, I don't know. Does this mean they're suddenly going to do wacky new things? I wouldn't think so. It's an institution. It's slow to change, right?
Yes, correct.
All right.
Yeah, it's kind of very, you know, like you said, you're not in Hollywood, so you didn't know him. But if you are in Hollywood, then you probably care about certain stories. In fact, it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, kind of like that last story. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, they most certainly will be affecting all of our listeners. Michael, Amazon has finally listened to us, and they will be selling ebooks along with hardcover and paperback books.
Well, they're bundling, saying if you bought a book from Amazon,
or if you buy one in the future.
Ever bought a hardcover book from Amazon and it's in this program called Matchbook, then you can get an ebook version of that book for anywhere from free to $3.
A couple things. One, really, Matchbook? You're talking about books here that burn. In any case, A. B, when does Apple and iTunes match, Sue?
Well, you know, there's not a lot of books involved in this program yet, about 10,000 titles, which is nothing, because to put it in perspective, 60,000 books come out every single week. So when you're talking about 10,000 titles, that's very little. Almost none of the major publishers are involved. They're freaked out about it. They're not sure what to think. HarperCollins has a few titles that are available. So you're not going to find a lot of new books here. You know, if you bought a book last week, like the new Salinger bio, you're not going to find that available on Matchbook, I assume.
Why are they so freaked out? Because let me tell you, I like real books, okay? I don't mind ebooks, but if I have a chance to buy a book and hold it in my hands and read it, I'll do that. However, I do like the ability to have an ebook of that same book, so that I can carry it with me in the future if I need to. So
or if you're traveling or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you're saying to me, look, this new hardcover, it's going to cost you $14.99 or $19.99. However, for $23, you can also get the ebook. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pay $23.
You're going to pay an extra $8?
Oh, $19.99 to $23?
$4,
an extra $4. Oh. So for an extra $3, I would definitely purchase the ebook along with the other book. Now, I realize that if I don't purchase the hardback or paperback book, that ebook, the cost of that ebook will go up. And I understand why that is.
Well, I don't think you should have to pay extra, because that's what people always want to do. It's like, no, they have an easy way to increase the value of the hardcover. And I think they should say, hey, you buy a hardcover book, great, we'll give you the ebook and the audiobook. Just like when you buy a new Pixar film on Blu-ray, you get a DVD and a digital copy included. You know, I don't think they should charge extra for that stuff. I think they should see that as a great way to add value to your purchase. If you only want the digital copy, you pay less. If you only want the ebook or you only want the audiobook, of course, you don't pay the same amount you'd pay for the bundle. But I don't think they should see it as a way to jack up prices. I think it's a way they should say, hey, look, we can offer this and make the book far more valuable. So Amazon's launched this. I think it's amazing. It does a couple things. One, it really rewards Amazon loyalty. If you're an Amazon customer and you bought a book back in the Clinton administration, back when Bill Clinton was president, if it's available in this program, you can get an ebook for maybe a dollar or two. That's really rewards loyalty.
You mean,
that's amazing.
You mean back when the 1992 Cable Act was only 7 years old?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So that's kind of amazing. But of course, they're freaked out about why do they not like this? Why are publishers afraid of this?
I have no idea. Well, please do tell me, because I like this, and I know that a lot of people will write in and say, but DVDs that have the Blu-rays and the digital this and the digital that, they cost, you know, $24 instead of just the DVD, which costs $19. But still, it's...
They often don't cost that much. I mean, they're not... They used to be pricier. Now it's sort of so standard. You kind of just get a Blu-ray and a digital or a Blu-ray, whatever. You know, it's
you
like...
You get it for the price of the Blu-ray.
They're pretty cheap now. They're pretty closer in price now, as they should be. Some people say it's great. One author was quoted in their press release as saying, of course, the idea this will kill sales is ridiculous. No one's going to buy a print edition and then a digital ebook edition as well. You know, they're forcing you to choose one or the other, but you can make an extra buck or two by bundling them. Why not? You
know? Yeah, why not?
Exactly. So that's true. But I realized something when I dealt with this and looked at this and talked about all the concerns and all the things that they were going over. If they did this, they have no way of really doing it. How are publishers? Publishers aren't prepared to bundle a book. If they said they wanted to bundle their new novel coming out in 2 weeks, what are they going to do? Most indie bookstores can barely sell you an ebook. They sure as heck can't offer bundling.
Oh, I know how they could do it. I know how they could do it.
What?
The same way they do Ultraviolet, which is here's the code.
Right, but they haven't done it. So Ultraviolet is an online digital locker where if you buy something, you go in with a code and you get the digital copy and there it is waiting for you. You can access it with your tablet, your iPad, whatever you need to do.
And it's always there.
Absolutely. And they should do that for books, but they haven't done it, right? They haven't done it. So they're so stupid that they have not even bothered. Like 5 years ago, they should have been saying, hey, we need to do something so that we're not dependent on Amazon and Barnes & Noble to provide ebooks.
Wait, the publishing industry get together and actually agree on something? That's like the like the movie industry getting together and agreeing on something.
So
it's never going to happen.
Today, if they went whole hog on this, what would happen? People would not buy books at their indie bookstore. You know, they'd go to Amazon. Because
Amazon
and Barnes
already doing
Noble,
that?
they are, but they would crush them now. Now you really would have an even bigger incentive not to ever go to your local indie bookstore again.
You know what? I'm not going to go to...
It's cheaper.
I'm not even going to go to Amazon. I'm going to stop buying books.
Right. Well, that's a possibility. There's one little point I would make here before we talk about this. People say, oh my God, but somebody said was very concerned. Will these ebooks be lendable? Won't that discourage sales? I have two copies of a book instead of one.
Hey, it's have like, you heard of a just, library?
Yeah, you're just an idiot. You know, it's like, first of all, you can give away your book when you're done anyway. So, I mean, all books are lendable. Ebooks should be lendable. And it's like, yeah, you know, come on, wake up. Wake up to the world
e-books,
that people live in.
Ebooks are lendable for 30 days at a time.
Well,
and when you lend, like, Kindle to Kindle, if I lend somebody my Kindle version of a book.
You can't access it.
I then can't access it until they're done and say, oh, I'm done. Here, send it back.
And what's the worst thing in the world that happens? The author gains a new fan.
Yeah.
And then the next book comes out and they will buy it. Like, relax. But Robert Gottlieb, who's a big agent, he actually wonders if publishers even have the right to do this for past books in their accounts. He says, based on current contracts with authors, he doesn't think they actually have the right to offer something like this, where you get a Kindle, an ebook copy for an extra buck or two. So, and he somehow decided it will discourage publishers from keeping books in print. Like, if you bundle books and make a copy of a book available as an ebook, they won't bother keeping the book in print.
Oh, so let me get... What? That makes no sense.
I know. Well, what he's thinking is, well, we don't have to provide a print copy because people can just get an ebook copy. But that's only if they've already purchased it. The other thing is they say, well, now you're just encouraging people. If they could do this for books that they bought 10 years ago, they can sell those books and pay extra for the Kindle or the ebook version and just be digital only.
So let me get this straight. A customer who has bought your book 10 years ago and is not ready to give you another dime for that same book, is willing to give you $3 for that same book. Interesting.
Right. Or they gave it as a, they said, what if they gave it as a gift? I'm like, so what? They bought it 8 years ago, and they're now willing to give you an extra $2 to get an ebook version of it. You've just made a sale.
You know what? Yeah, forget it. I'll
or
just
if they have it. If they have it on their library for on their shelf for 8 years, it's a beloved book that they actually enjoy. So, you know, why do you think they're still going to want to throw it out or give it to the library or sell it at the used bookstore? You know, if they've had it all these years, they probably like it.
True.
I mean, it's just crazy. So it's I think it's the wave of the future. I think publishers are wrong to be leery of this. I think they need to set up something like Ultraviolet, a digital locker, so they can start providing digital ebooks and audiobooks to people without depending on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So they can offer bundling so that indie bookstores can compete. And they're way behind on this. It'd be years before they can do something like that.
Hey, maybe they should do it through Bookfilter.
That's right.
Just a thought. But in any case, what do you think of this whole thing with Oyster? I mean, is this the wave of the future? Is basically a Netflix for books a wave of the future? I kind of like the whole idea. I don't read enough because I'm kind of an idiot and kind of dumb.
Well, let's explain what Oyster is. Oyster is a new service.
Wow, you didn't even take the bait there. I was called myself an idiot.
I just savored it and moved along.
Okay.
So it's a new service. You pay $10 a month. You get access to 100,000 titles, and you can read as many as you want.
Horrible idea.
It's sort of like Netflix. Of course, 100,000 titles is a drop in a bucket.
That's like a week and a half.
Right. I guess we should actually call it closer to Spotify. People say, everybody wants to say it's a Netflix for books, but actually Netflix now is sort of like HBO, where they have some big exclusive properties, and then they have a library of stuff that's not wildly comprehensive, but it's so big that you sort of can always find something you want. Just like maybe you're on HBO or HBO On Demand, you can usually find some movie or TV show you want to watch, but it's not like you get everything in the world there. Whereas Spotify, if it's a new album, it's going to be available on Spotify. Almost everything is available on Spotify. So if Oyster was the new Spotify, you would go on there and every new book that came out this week would be there, right? That's Spotify. Netflix is, hey, we've got content. You like our library. It's, you know, maybe we'll have some exclusive content down the road, but there's enough of a library there of older stuff that it's worth your while to subscribe to it because you feel like you get your value.
Okay.
So I mean, that's an interesting distinction people make because they're clearly not Spotify because there have almost no new bestsellers available on this. They have very few deals with top publishers. They don't have a lot of big titles and big names from new releases. It's really about the library and the catalog of the publishers. Is it worth $10 a month?
I think, you know what, for $120 a month or a year, you could read any book you wanted. Yeah, it's worth it.
But I mean, if you go in there and look, say, oh, I want to read this new book that came out, you're going to get very frustrated very quickly because won't be there.
That is correct. Selection definitely has to increase for this to be worth it. Now, let's see what the publishers are getting out of me today. I buy a few books a year.
Mm-hmm. So then you're highly unlikely to want to pay $10 a month to access more books,
right? No, this is not for me. This is definitely not for me. I read books generally that get sent to me, actually, by publicists. Most of them are nonfiction. So,
right. Now, I don't feel like my website Bookfilter is remotely in competition with Oyster.
No, not at all.
If you're looking for a book to read, before you go to your library or your bookstore or you go online to Amazon or you go to Oyster and check in, you can come to my website and find examples of books you might want to read. I have a bunch of new releases, stuff that came out in the last few months. You get a long list of great titles that would be intriguing, and you can find them at one of those places. So I'm recommending stuff, and then you go to where you can get the book.
You're a curator. You're a right. Recommendation engine, if you will.
Right. So I don't think I'm in conflict with them. So if I run them down, I don't think I'm going to gain anything by it. I like the idea. I think Netflix for books seems inevitable, or Spotify for books, whatever you want, a subscription service. It's going to have all the publishers signed up and a big, broad selection. They don't have that yet. But what I don't understand is they launched with just an app for the iPhone.
Yeah, right? Just the iPhone, not the iPad.
The iPad. And they said the iPad's coming in the fall. But if you're going to launch, wouldn't you launch with the iPad?
Well,
I mean, why the iPhone?
Well, because they did, speaking of nonfiction books, I'm in the middle of The Lean Startup right now, a nonfiction book by Eric Ries, which talks about the minimum viable product. And that's what they did here. They basically made the bare minimum product that they could make, launched it. Now they're learning what works and what doesn't. And I think they were probably learning, hey, we need an iPad version.
Well, But why wouldn't you start with the iPad version? That's what people read on.
Yeah,
I know people can read books on their phone. I know some people do. I've read a short story or two once in a while when I got trapped without any other reading material. But obviously, a lot more reading gets done on your tablet or your Kindle or your Nook. So I don't understand why you would start with the phone rather than the tablet.
I do not know.
They also say they have no plans for an Android app, which makes no sense to me whatsoever. Now, I've seen conflicting comments. That was from their website. Some other people said, oh, it's in the works. Well, their website says they have no plans for an Android app. That makes no sense to me. That's the dominant phone company. Why would you not have that in the works?
Well, it's the dominant operating system, phone operating system.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't understand the launch. I guess I understand the idea. They've got millions of dollars in backing. They can afford to launch when it's not ready for prime time, and they can work out the kinks in public.
Yeah.
I guess my website, I've took the opposite stupid approach of saying I have to make it be in pretty darn good shape before I go public because I don't want it to fall on its face. And I want them to look at it and not have a lot of excuses never to come back. If you look at Oyster's list of books, you'd say, well, I'm not coming back. They've not very few titles. You know, nothing I want to read. You know, you can find books on there to read, I imagine, but I'm going to pay $10 a month to try and scrounge through their listings to find a book. I want the new releases. I want the top names. I want the stuff. And none of that's there. So then I'd never go back.
Well, now, speaking of going back or coming back, we'd like our listeners to come back. So we should probably wrap up for this week so that, you know, the show doesn't run into next week's show. Kind of tell you that you could find all of the stories that we talked about, including that one about Oyster, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to subscribe to us. You can subscribe to us pretty much in any podcast aggregator, anywhere they give out podcasts for free, specifically iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, and please do rate and review the show in those aggregators, in those directories.
Venues,
yes. Good word. You can also follow us. We have a Twitter account, which is at Showbiz Sandbox on Twitter. We have a Facebook page that you can like. It is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That's where you can find us. We have an email address. You can email us to explain what the word agita means. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of this information, all links to all the stories we talked about today are on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found, I guess, this week on Jimmy Fallon.
That's right, they're on Wednesday night, Thursday morning.
Yes, or on their website, who is mgmt.com. And of course, Michael, you have bookfilter.com and a couple of other websites.
Oh, that's right, you can find me on goodluckoyster.com.
And you can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com, where this week I think we talked about promoting movie theaters via Groupon. Until next week, play nice.